Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast that comes on home. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser. Comes on home. That has been the culmination of our near year-long search for a snappy tagline.
Sort of. Not really. It just happens to fit because, yes, we are indeed looking at a Canadian movie this week. And what film would that happen to be, Andrew?
Well, what a Canadian film. From the absolutely bizarre conceptual mishmash of last week's White Nights, we have followed one Isabella Rossellini to this week. We're looking at Denis Villeneuve's 2013 film Enemy, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, Melanie Laurent, Sarah Gadon, and Isabella Rossellini, with a script by Javier Goulon, cinematography by Nicolas Balduc, and filmed in the city of Toronto.
Yes, and we should probably note right up front that while this is technically a Canadian movie, it's also really a Canadian-Spanish co-production. Make of that what you will with international financing.
Yeah, they're right next to each other, right?
Yeah, I'm just saying, with international financing being what it is, it's kind of hard to determine what it even means to be a film of one country or another. I just got to use the notion of it was mostly shot here, directed by a Canadian, and set explicitly in a Canadian city as the basis for this being a Canadian movie.
That might be an interesting point to begin our conversation this week, because when we talk about American cinema, we mean Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in the same way that when we talk about, like, international art cinema, that's really just shorthand for what's going to screen at Cannes. And despite the fact that Canada has a long and very storied history of film production, certainly as a site for shooting, the birthplace of a number of prominent actors in the present, looking at you, my man Ryan Gosling, the idea of defining Canadian cinema, that's always been sort of a challenge to scholars. And I mean, like, you and I mean, I'm pretty sure we've taken some of the same courses at Wilfrid Laurier, and
yeah.
I remember we did do Canadian cinema extensively, and one of the biggest questions is there such a thing as Canadian cinema in the same way that we refer to other national cinemas?
Well, and this is the thing, because this is a long and very broad topic. Canadian cinema, when we're talking about it, I think our big issue is that we don't have the same industrial or exhibition levels for our own productions that other countries do. For example, if you go to see the cinema in France, odds are you're going to see a number of homegrown French films being shown alongside imports from other countries there. In Canada, we make movies, but getting them distributed is not our strong point on our own shores, really. And there's a long and complicated history as for why that's the case. Part of it stems from the fact that, yes, our national cinema was originally overseen partly at the behest of our British overlords, who basically saw upon it that...
Overlords, yeah. Dave says what he's really thinking.
Yes. And I say this, don't get me wrong, I love British cinema, I love Britain, but, you know, we have a complicated history with them. And one of the things they did was encourage us to do documentaries, mainly as a way to pretty much leave the British market alone as far as creating commercial cinema that way. And certainly our government has done an incredibly poor job at trying to encourage Canadian cinema by protecting our exhibition market. So, yeah, at one point in time, we basically pretty much put our hands up and said to the United States, hey, guess what? You got free rein over here. And that's kind of a problem when you consider that how on earth is Canada a large and, you know, fairly well-off nation, but without a giant commercial infrastructure there to support cinema, going to compete with the glossy Hollywood product coming over?
Well, yeah, there's a bunch of pieces that don't really seem to fit, whether you're looking at the present or history. I mean, digital distribution has undoubtedly made it a lot easier for Canadian creators to get their work, distributed in a global marketplace. And, you know, you have things like the Toronto International Film Festival, which, of the festival circuit, like, it has pretty high stature. And yet, at the same time, like, when you look at, it feels like Canadian cinema often becomes one of two things. Either it is this stock archetypal view of Canada that's then distributed in a global marketplace, and then you end up with things like Men with Brooms or Bon Cop, Bad Cop, which, even though they're hits, I mean, not necessarily indicative of Canadian culture, and certainly not the bulk of Canadian cinema. Or you end up with, like, smaller films like Margaret's Museum, which do feel uniquely Canadian, and there's absolutely no reason for anybody outside of Canada to seek them out and watch them. So instead, like, Canada's influence ends up being more diffuse than anything. I mean, David Cronenberg was born here, and now he goes wherever he wants in the world and makes weird films. And then people write essays 15 years after the fact explaining all this weirdness on being born in Canada. But I think all of that leads to probably one of our more higher profile exports in recent years, and that is the director of this week's film, Denis Villeneuve, who, those of you who follow me on Twitter will know that I think he is a good filmmaker who makes good films. But I mean, certainly in recent years, probably around the year 2013, Denis Villeneuve goes from making very regional and very distinctly Canadian films such as Polytechnique, Maelstrom, and Incendie, which is a fantastic film. This is sort of the point where he goes from being an obscure and eccentric French director to suddenly being, like, at the vanguard of, like, commercially palatable art cinema.
Yeah, and we should probably note one thing as well, just to qualify, because I'm sure anybody who knows the history of Canadian cinema will probably come after us for not noting it. Quebecois cinema is basically exists on an island of its own in terms of its industrial aspects and identity. I would say probably that is more or less the better established and definitive part of Canadian filmmaking, in the sense that, yeah, that sort of exists in its own. It has its own audience, and it's able to sustain itself in a way that English language Canada simply hasn't there. And if I'm not mistaken, Villeneuve is definitely, if I'm not mistaken, originates as part of the Quebecois cinema. You can probably speak to that better than I can, Andrew. But
I mean, the way I understand it, though, is that certainly something like Polytechnique, which is about the Montreal Massacre, like, that's a film that's linked to a very distinct moment in not just Quebecois culture, but Canadian history as well.
Yeah.
And whereas, like, his earlier films, like Maelstrom, for instance, is a semi-tragedy involving intersecting lives around a car accident that's being narrated by a fish on a butcher's block. So there's, I guess, he's always been a Canadian filmmaker in the sense that he's not at all hesitant to let his eccentricities show.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, I think certainly by this point in time, and even with a work like Incendie, like, there's no sense that he is making a film that speaks about Canadian values per se. And what we see here in Enemy is, even though, like, it's unmistakably a film shot and set in Toronto, it's not necessarily located to that urban space as much as what it's doing with space is more indicative of urban spaces in general. Like, there's, I guess, as a counterpoint, another Denny, for instance, Denny Arcand, you look at a film like The Barbarian Invasions or Fall of the American Empire, he is making interesting and challenging art cinema, but he's doing it from a specifically Canadian context. Whereas there's something about Villeneuve's work that seems a bit more freeform. Like, he's more interested in commenting on the human condition rather than the Canadian one.
Well, his work, particularly as far as this film goes, because I can't speak to the movies he made prior to Enemy. I still need to see them. Please don't yell at me too much on Twitter. But it's certainly the case of a filmmaker who, it very much feels like he was closer to the genre films of the 70s and 80s. That, again, to the prior named David Cronenberg here, was very much experimenting with, where, yeah, in many instances, they are set in Canada, but that's yeah, it is more peripheral to what's going on. It just so happens that, yeah, Rabbit is set in Canada. It just so happens that The Brood is set in Canada. And occasionally you get some regionalism or quirk that very much indicates it. But there's nothing explicitly, yeah, about the themes of those films that pins it as being exclusively to Canada. Although, having said that, as we get into Enemy, there is one quasi-reading, or I shouldn't say quasi-reading, but there is been at least one thing suggested about the film that I think its Canadian setting will complicate a bit, but I don't want to get ahead of myself here. But I think this is a good point, Andrew, to take us to the exact nature of this movie and its production background, starting with probably where do the origins of this project lie?
Okay, well, from what I've been able to gather, all right. This, funny enough for a movie about doubling, this is actually one of two films that Villeneuve released in 2013. The other was the much higher profile film Prisoners, which also starred Jake Gyllenhaal, but also featured a much more all-star cast, had some Villeneuvian sensibilities, and it's a very dark film, but it's also very glossy, and you can sort of see that it's being positioned towards a much wider audience. I mean, Wolverine gets second billing, so. Whereas Enemy is a much smaller film, and in interviews, Villeneuve has said this is, to date, his most personal film. So at this point in time, I mean, he was working on Prisoners and built up a certain degree of critical cachet, and it turns out that the book, or the film itself, is a loose adaptation of José Saramago's novel The Double. And if I'm not mistaken, Saramago also wrote the novel Blindness, which yes, was turned into a Canadian film and definitely received a lot less warmly than the novel. But apparently Villeneuve had an interest in the book after reading it, and by a funny coincidence, he ended up making the acquaintance of producer, Niv Fickman, Canadian super producer, who coincidentally happened to own the adaptation rights to the novel. So at the same time that he's making Prisoner, he begins working on this film in Toronto. And as a result, because he has to split his time, he pretty much outsources the script, which he originally intended to write on, to Javier Guillon, who is a Spanish writer, from what I gather. And the editor in this film, Matthew Hannum, I bring that up not only because the film has very distinct editing patterns, but apparently Hannum was given a great deal of latitude over the final cut of the film. So in certain respects, this may be Villeneuve's most personal film, but from a production standpoint, it's also one of his least personal in terms of direct involvement, because as interviews with the cast and crew have indicated, they would basically shoot certain segments, and then Villeneuve would have to disappear down to the States to shoot more of Prisoners, and whenever he could work around it, he came back north to take care of his real project.
Yeah, which certainly is not something that typically happens, particularly when you've heard about production histories where you're working 16 to 20 hour days trying to get something made. Shooting two movies at the same time sounds like a nightmare and probably likely taking a personal toll on your health before you even factor in the, border crossing travel required between the two.
Yeah, because this is all post-2001, everybody. Maybe it's different if you're famous. But yeah, so, I mean, at heart, Enemy is a film that is deceptively simple because, I mean, it's a very simple elevator pitch. The film involves, we first begin by being introduced to Adam Bell, who is played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who's a history professor. And without really giving much exposition, we see that his life leaves a little to be desired. And as circumstances have it, one night while falling asleep watching a movie, he ends up discovering that one of the extras in the background happens to be his exact physical double. I mean, that's the plot, right? But in the telling of that story, a lot of very interesting things come out, and I think that's where we really get to see Villeneuve's influence as a creator. because the journey that we go on stemming from that setup probably is not the one that audiences are expecting. And judging by the text you sent me at 12 o'clock at night the other day, probably not the journey you were expecting either.
Certainly not. And, I mean, at this point, we should probably note that the notion of doing films about doppelgangers is not something that is without precedent in film history or culture in general. As our colleague Dr. Drew Jefferies would love to point out, seeing as how he's taught courses on doppelganger cinema himself. And certainly you can think of ones from anything from such as the Star Trek Mirror Universe episodes, which are absolutely fascinating to watch, to things such as, most recently, the Twin Peaks revival, I think is probably the biggest one that I think a lot of people will be thinking about.
In maybe a less sinister sense, you have films like The Double Life of Veronique, or even like Sliding Doors, you know?
The Prince of the Pauper.
In film, the doppelganger usually emerges, I mean, generally in a psych horror context. Generally, it's in a narrative that intends to explore the fundamental duality of man.
So, I mean, going into it, the film thematically doesn't necessarily stray that far from previously tread territory, but you are quite right, Andrew, in that the telling of this one and the conclusions it reaches, if any, are decidedly different. So I think it's at the point we should probably note and give our usual warning, which we didn't do last episode. Spoilers ahead. If you want to watch this film completely fresh at this point, bail out now. Go watch it. It's a very quick watch at 91 minutes in length. And then come back to us right after. We'll still be here. That's the power of podcasting. But
a theater of the mind. The difficulty in describing this film is that in trying to chart out this narrative, that doesn't really seem to speak to what the film is really about. But I can't think of a better way to go about it, so why don't we do that?
Well, I think it's not dissimilar, I would say, structurally from something like David Lynch's Lost Highway, where you can really sort of divide the film into roughly two halves, speaking. The first one focusing on the previously mentioned Adam. And should we just probably go into more depth at this point with his side of the film before...
I think so, because though, I mean, the film does, and you quite rightly pointed out in the notes, I mean, there's doubling, but it's asymmetrical. And I think certainly in terms of who we follow through the film and who we identify with, Adam's our guy. But the film doesn't begin with Adam. The film begins with a quote from the novel itself that says, "Chaos is order as yet undeciphered." Now remember that, everybody, because we're going to come back there. The first image we get, though, is Adam, or is he, walking through an underground dimly lit hallway where he enters a door where a whole bunch of very well-dressed businessmen are sitting. And we quickly learn that it's a special kind of club, isn't it, David?
Yeah, this is the type of whacked-out... art house erotic club that you only find in art house movies. Typically, I don't know how often these underground clubs actually exist in real life, but yes, this is for the person who wants their erotic show to make them feel smarter, I guess. I don't know. You decide.
It's classy when it's not in your basement. So Adam ends up going to this place, and this whole scene, there is no dialogue. So we're not given any context or exposition. Instead, we watch as Adam joins this group of people, and they proceed to watch as a woman disrobes, puts on stiletto heels, and then proceeds to crush a tarantula on a silver dining platter. Then we're introduced to Adam, who, yes, he is a history professor. Is it Ryerson they shoot at?
Honestly, not positive. It's one of the major Toronto University campuses, whether it's Ryerson or the University of Toronto. I didn't attend either of those institutions, so I can't say.
Maybe it's York, because it looks like a gray island in the middle of nowhere. But
could be.
All that to say is that Adam is a history professor, and through the initial montage, we see that his life is something of a routine. He ends up going to teach classes, which I know we'll talk more about, that you signaled it's your pet peeve, but lectures his students on the nature of power, control, and dictatorships throughout history, and the tendency for history to repeat itself. And as he's doing that, we then see his routine of coming home and spending his evening eating and drinking with, with Mary, presumably his girlfriend, played by Melanie Laurent. There's not a lot of dialogue between the couple, and I mean, there's definitely a pattern happening through the film. We're not given much by way of exposition. So the two of them, they basically hang out, they see with each other, they sleep together, and then the next day he goes, lectures, and the cycle repeats itself. And the way that this is framed, though, I mean, it's with the rapid editing, the lack of dialogue, and especially the overlapping on the audio track of his lecture to the students, and the idea of everything is about control and history repeats itself, we're given the pretty distinct impression that Adam isn't where he wants to be.
Yeah, and basically nothing really disrupts this until he has a very peculiar bit of small talk conversation with, I'm going to assume it's a colleague. It's never quite clear who this other individual is. Could be somebody from the same department as Adam. Could be just some random individual who just happened to be wanting to strike up a conversation with a person who really doesn't want to be talking to you. But the subject of, you know, are you a movie guy, comes up, and Adam quickly establishes that he's not. But, you know, he'd be happy to watch something cheerful. And he has a local film recommended to him, which, okay, no big whoop. Except he decides to take a slight detour after work to, presumably rent a copy of said film before he heads back to his apartment.
Yeah, and from Queen Video, no less. But I mean, that's the first immersion breaker of the film, the fact that there are still operating video stores in 2019.
This is 2013, so, but yeah.
True enough, it gets past. Love you, DV. He dozes off watching it, and at first, it's not like, the way that the film introduces the plot point is very interesting, because nothing seems to be untoward. He finishes watching the movie and goes to sleep, and then he has what, at first we're not sure if it's a dream sequence or just a recap of the film, but from his own point of view, it seems. And then, in his dream, he then becomes aware that, no, a guy who looks exactly like him was playing the bellhop. And sure enough, he wakes up, looks up the film, freezes on the image, and realizes, yes, one of the people in this film looks exactly like he does. So he investigates and then realizes that, oh, it turns out that this person is an actor that happens to also live in Toronto. And that's how we're introduced to Anthony, who is also played by Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yes, but it takes us a while to get to Anthony proper, because once Adam makes this discovery, instead of doing what I think most of us would do, which would be, huh, that's nifty, and now have a party trick that you can pull out and say, by the way, if they ever made a movie out of my life, this is the guy to get, he gets a little more obsessive about this idea. And in the process, more or less does what we would say is stalking. Basically faking his way in by playing Anthony as he goes to presumably an office for some sort of film.
It's the talent agency that represents him.
Yeah.
I believe. Yeah. And he does it in the most comically inept way possible.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he's basically alternating between like cold sweat and, just like this building obsession with finding out who this guy is. So we watch as he buys cheap sunglasses and hides in his car and waits for people to leave the building and then feverishly try and run for the door before it closes.
Yeah.
So he ends up getting into the building, though, and after some more cryptic conversation with the guards, he's given an envelope addressed to Anthony.
Yeah, and even though it says personal and confidential, he keeps hold of it. And from that,
that's a federal offense, by the way.
It is. He also figures out from this piece of from this envelope where he lives. And in the process, he manages to head over to the apartment after kind of scoping it out in a way that is, I mean, again, one of the sort of surreal details we'll find about this film is just how empty Toronto seems to be when you're walking outside. But yeah, he ends up going to a payphone and trying to call into the apartment and doesn't quite get Anthony, but instead gets Helen, who turns out to be Anthony's wife, and she's convinced that Adam is her husband at first.
Yeah, she assumes that it's a joke, but then as the conversation goes on and the fact that Adam is not like giving up the ghost or suddenly doing that, yeah, it's me, the fact that he's incredibly insistent on that he doesn't know who this woman is, like, she quickly becomes very frightened by it. And then Adam, once again, without really saying anything, just in a moment of panic, apologizes, hangs up the phone, and then drives home, shuts the blinds, and just paces.
Yeah. Eventually, he works up the, I won't say courage to call again, but at least the obsession enough to call again. And this time, yeah, he gets a hold of Anthony, who at first is trying to figure out what on earth is going on. Why is he giving these harassing calls? Before Adam sort of starts, you know, in a rather irrational thing, saying, "Hey, by the way, I've happened to find out we look like one another, and I just needed to, you know, see you." None of this comes across like being a stalker.
Which, I mean, to be fair, Anthony's first instinct is assume that this is just a crazed fan. I mean, I don't know why someone would be like, "Oh, I loved you so much as a background player in three local movies. Want to hang out? I identify with you." But, I mean, I think given what we learn of Anthony's character, ego is kind of a problem for him. But he just assumes that somebody is starstruck and at first thinks nothing of it. But the problem is that Helen overhears the conversation. And here's where I think the film starts showing kind of its mastery in the narrative, despite the fact that it is so deliberately opaque at times.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as we foreground, like, there's not a ton of dialogue in this film. There's not a ton of moments where, like, Villeneuve and co. hit you over the head and say, "This is what this represents, everyone." Instead, what happens is that places a much greater emphasis on what is said and what is shown. And in very small gestures, this film can convey quite a bit. So after Helen hears that phone conversation, she asks Anthony about it. He insists he was on the phone with another man, some crazy stalker. And then she pauses and just gives him a look and says, "Have you been seeing her again?" And that's all we get of it. But that tells us all we need to know about sort of the state of the couple. And I think what I caught this time around viewing it is that in that conversation, we do not see Helen in profile until the very end of that scene when they basically have a fight, they walk off, and then we get the shot and realize, oh, Helen is also visibly quite pregnant.
Yeah, and there's another interesting attention to detail here on Villeneuve's part that I think is interesting, which is the way in which the phone conversation between Adam and Anthony is staged. We only see it from Adam's perspective. It's only after the phone is hung up that we see Anthony emerge from the other room to talk to Helen about what just happened in this phone call. Yeah, and that's
correct. It's almost like in Psycho, how everyone remembers the shower scene. But what most people fail to remember is prior to the shower scene, we are completely restricted to following Janet Leigh's character. Whereas it's only right before when she leaves, the camera finally lingers and then starts following Norman. And that is the turning point in the film. And a similar thing happens here.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's not accidental, but again, how you choose to interpret some of this, this is where it'll get complicated. But from this point forward, what ends up happening is, yes, Adam and Anthony do indeed finally get a chance to meet up at an anonymous hotel that Anthony is aware of. I wonder why.
Which, again, conveys quite a bit without any dialogue at all.
Yes, and Adam drives out there, arrives, and walks into a unlit room, never bothering to turn on a light. Another significant point which keeps recurring throughout at least his side of the film. And, yeah, we finally get the face-off at about probably, I say this is what, about 40 minutes in, which is about the halfway point of this movie.
Yeah, where it's a slow build to this moment. After that, it kind of ramps up in a hurry. But, yeah, they defer the actual meeting. And I think narratively, though, both characters kind of give reason to defer as well. Because Anthony is initially dismissive, and even in those early phone calls, though, he asks Adam, like, well, what do you actually want? And I may be mistaken on this, but I'm pretty sure that every time Adam is asked that, he doesn't ever answer. He doesn't explain what he's looking for or why he wants to meet. And I think that's very interesting, because at one and the same time, he's absolutely fixated on meeting his double and confirming that he does exist, but he's not sure why either. And I guess it makes sense in the same way that, I mean, you think it would be a great party gag, but I'm like, if I ever encountered my exact double, it's like that wouldn't necessarily mean or prove anything unto itself. But how could it not, you know? So it's that confusion, and I think, I mean, delving into it thematically, we'll get back to. But Adam doesn't seem to know what he wants, and certainly at first, neither does Anthony.
Well, no. And it's interesting, though, once the meeting finally happens up, a couple things become very clear. One, this doubling isn't just of, you know, their face. There is, like, pretty much every physical detail, including a particular scar that Anthony has, is doubled between them. And as this is becoming increasingly clear, yeah, Adam starts freaking out and, you know, suddenly realizes maybe meeting your doppelganger in a mysterious Toronto motel wasn't the wisest choice he could have made, and bolts. However, at this point in time, you know, Anthony has now become a little bit more invested in this situation. Although at this point in time, we should also note that that letter that Adam grabbed from the talent agency, he does leave on the bed for Anthony to take. Again, why he doesn't assume that eventually Anthony won't bring him up on charges for mail fraud, you decide, listener.
I think they got more pressing matters, but yeah, so what ends up happening is then we suddenly see sort of a reversal. So Adam's, you know, his terrible attempt at stalking Anthony earlier, that then becomes doubled in its own way when Anthony starts following Adam to try and get a glimpse into his life. And more importantly, what becomes the object of his fascination, it's not Adam, but he sees him with Mary. And then he begins following her onto a streetcar, which, again, for those of you who have ever been to Toronto and use public transit, you'll know it's a Canadian film. But he ends up following her at a distance in a very troubling scene. Like, it's nothing but voyeurism. And it seems that the real linchpin of the scene is when he notices that Mary is wearing a pair of leopard print heeled shoes.
Yeah. So what do we would one assume that something of a slight egomaniac who with implications of infidelity is going to do in this situation?
Well, in this case, Anthony gets to scheming real quick, and we end up being given this very confusing scene at first of him, what we then understand is him rehearsing dialogue in a mirror for an eventual confrontation with Adam, where he accuses Adam, he points out that Adam first called and spoke to Helen, and he uses that as a pretext to accuse Adam of sleeping with Helen, and as a way of getting even and making things right, he proposes that they meet up, trade clothes, spend a night with each other's partner, return, swap back, and disappear from each other's lives.
Yeah, and before this confrontation is able to happen, though, Adam does have one little scene with another character in this film, his mother, played by Isabella Rossellini, in which a very peculiar detail or statement is dropped by her as Adam tries to explain the freakiness of this situation to her, which she is being fairly dismissive of. And ultimately, she drops this thing about, you know, him giving up this dream of being a third-rate B-movie actor there. And Adam seems legitimately confused at this, as I think the viewer should be as well, because nothing that we would know of what he's described at this point suggests that he wants to be an actor, necessarily. At least, not that we've literally witnessed in this scene. And things get a little more... So, again, little shoe drop there that may or may not be significant. You decide. We do, however, get the very clear sense that Adam's relationship with his mother is problematic in the sense that, yeah, she is very controlling of him as well.
Yeah, perhaps another ode to Hitchcock in that regard. But it's also interesting because the whole... Isabella Rossellini appears in this film for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, and yet the way that she's introduced as a character is, again, remarkably economical. Because, really, our first introduction, Adam's phone rings, and the call display, it doesn't say mom, it says mother. Yeah. And I think that in itself tells us something about their dynamic, and when we do finally get the breakfast meeting between the two, she dismisses his idea of having a double and says, no, I don't have any other children. Stop chasing this fantasy. You have a nice, normal life. Now maintain it. Now eat your blueberries, which he insists yes. he doesn't like, and she insists that he does. And that's it for Isabella.
Yeah.
And that takes us to, I guess, Anthony's plan coming to fruition. Because at this point, Anthony, like, he is much more direct, certainly much more aggressive than Adam. And unlike Adam, he at least has a clear sense of what he wants. However, it happens to be, like, the worst moral choice that could be made. But the two agree to meet up, swap lives for a day. And then what happens, Dave?
Well, I would say, first of all, I would say, I'm not sure it's they agree to swap lives for a day so much as Anthony shows up, basically tells him, this is what's going down, you don't get a say in it. And, yeah, Adam, from everything we see, says nothing in response. So, yeah, Anthony goes ahead, gets dressed up in Adam's clothes, leaves Adam in his apartment, and then takes off to go pick up Mary. Meanwhile, while their romantic getaway, quote-unquote, is happening, Adam basically finally decides to get up, leave his apartment, and make his way back to Anthony's place, where he... It's not really clear that he's intentionally going in with the intent of pretending to be Anthony, but he certainly doesn't object to that once Helen starts believing that's who he is. In this instance.
Well, but first, in order to get there, though, he realizes he doesn't have keys, and then the building manager lets him in, and as they're riding in the elevator, this is the only real exposition we get about that opening club shot, where the building manager talks about how it was so incredible being there the other night. He's wondering if he can get another key so they can go back there, and then... In a line that, again, I think speaks more than initially it appears, he says, I'd like to go back. And then he pauses, and more insistently, I need to go back. And with that, he lets Adam as Anthony into the apartment. And sure enough, he ends up meeting up with Helen, who... It's almost the Columbo dilemma of when do they realize, but it doesn't take long for Helen to pretty clearly know that the man in the apartment is not her husband. Just as this is parallel cut with Anthony taking Mary to the same hotel, and in the midst of coitus, it doesn't take long for her to figure it out too. But this leads to very different outcomes.
Yeah, basically, in the case of what's going on with Adam, although I would say, again, in my reading of the scene, I don't know whether it's entirely clear whether Helen is or isn't aware of it is him, but she knows something's off, if nothing else. And certainly we see eventually Adam having a breakdown in tears over seemingly just being overwhelmed by this entire situation that he's found himself in. And there's Helen to comfort him, and he seems accepting of that. And yes, this leads to, yes, another instance of coitus. However, meanwhile...
Well, but she does know, because when they finally curl up together, and, you know, I mean, obviously Adam is... If there's one thing that's clear through the film, Adam is not great at thinking on his feet or acting convincingly when he's trying to convince somebody. So after some hemming and hawing, though, they curl up together, and... I don't know if it's deliberately mixed to be quiet on the audio, but Helen asks, "Did you have a good day at school?" And
see, that's the funny thing, because again, it's a good point that you bring that up, because to me, when reading that, I didn't read that as her realizing that it's Adam as opposed to Anthony. To me, this is a case where I think the line is blurring between the two. But maybe that's getting ahead of the curve here on that one.
Well, I bring that up only because, and the one scene we forgot to mention, is that Helen, when she's convinced that Anthony's having an affair, she ends up looking Adam up and then going to the campus he's teaching on, and she starts following him, and they have a brief encounter.
Yeah.
And so I think given that, when she says the line, "Did you have a good day at school?" and he asks her to repeat that, and she just says nothing. But then later, when Adam has his breakdown on the couch and she comforts him, she says, again, very quietly, "You can stay if you want to." And I think if that's in context of her talking to her husband, that doesn't make sense.
You're right. No, that is fair. I'd forgotten that latter point of dialogue. So... good point.
So in this sort of half of the dynamic, though, we see that Helen pretty much prefers Adam to Anthony.
Yeah.
Whereas, meanwhile, at the hotel, Mary ends up noticing that, well, the key difference between the two men, it's not that one has a scar and the other doesn't, but Anthony is married, and that means he has a mark on his finger from wearing a wedding ring, which she notices, and rightly so, completely freaks out.
Yeah.
And so she insists that he takes her home, and as they're driving, they proceed to start arguing, and then they happen to have a high-speed rollover, and both of them are presumed dead in the crash.
Yeah. And cutting from that grisly fate, we then come back to the apartment where there's Adam, you know, getting dressed and set for the day, having seemingly come comfortably into who he is, and being told that there's a call from his mother that he should take, which again, a very interesting detail, particularly if we go with the reading that yes, she's well aware that Adam isn't her husband. How we wish choose to take that, I guess we'll
be debating.
And it's
also interesting that, considering the impactful presence that Adam's mother has in the film, despite her limited screen time, that's one of those areas where we do have that asymmetry, because we don't know who Anthony's mother is. We don't know if it's, you know, Isabella Rossellini with a pointed beard or anything of that sort. Like, that's one of those things where the film teases us, where it's like, we could give you an answer right now, but we're not going to.
Yeah, ultimately what does end up happening is Adam seems to be comfortably settling into his, I guess, new existence, whether he's going to pretend to be Anthony or whether it's just his a symbolic joining of his identities. Again, we're going to steer into this in a moment, folks, as to our interpretations of the film. But what he ends up discovering is he notices that letter he gave Anthony back earlier and decides, to hell with it, I'm going to commit further mail fraud and open it up. And in doing so, he discovers a key. Which, given the conversation in the elevator about needing a key to get into that little club, is not insignificant. And he basically pockets it, you know, sort of nervously wondering what this is and what it means. When he goes over to see Helen for a moment, and Andrew, what does he find in there?
Well, Adam basically calls and says, "Do you have any plans tonight? Because I might be out a bit late." And then he walks into the bedroom to find that where Helen presumably was standing, there is a giant spider that reacts as if somebody's caught them in the bathroom, and it shies away. And then the final shot of the film is just the reverse of Adam's face as he just stares, and then gives this weird sigh of resignation, and then the film ends.
Yep!
This is a film, I will point out, that routinely pops up on, like, the 10 scariest endings of all time. Not because this film is horror in the same way that, oh, I don't know, A Quiet Place is horror. It's not horror the same way that even Cronenberg is horror, but the sheer abruptness of that final, well, penultimate shot, if you want to be technical, the abruptness of that finish, like, no one sees it coming, and this is why I love recommending that movie, because it gets you every time.
Well, the thing about it is, you're right, it doesn't strike one as particularly Cronenbergian or a typical horror film, but it is so reminiscent of David Lynch, if not necessarily in the content of the shot itself. The way in which this film plays with the notion of doppelgangers and the reality in which people exist. If you've seen things like Lost Highway, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, you are going to recognize this is a world that is created that doesn't make total coherent sense. Because, as we were sort of acknowledging in the notes as we were sketching this one out, nothing quite works together perfectly to give you a proper answer as to what the situation is.
Yeah, it's, and even comparing this to sort of contemporaneous art films, like Darren Aronofsky may be a good instance where, like, you take a film like Mother, and it's like, the only way to make it sensible is to read it on an allegorical and thematic level.
Yeah.
Whereas with a film like this, I mean, it's got a presumably straightforward plot, but there are deliberate gaps that, and like very charged images that speak to something more than just what we are seeing. Like, if we're simply going off of exposition and what we are shown as viewers, this film's narrative is incomplete. But if you try and read it purely as a thematic reading, it seems the film resists giving you a complete, like, thematic structure for the film. Whatever way you want to look at the film, there's something absent that prevents us from, like, developing a unified reading of it.
Well, it's the interesting thing where I think one of the reasons why, I think what this film gets right in the same way that Lynch, when playing with things, and I'm going to come back to Lost Highway, is probably the key example of this. Is
I think
that,
that's a good contemporary counterpoint for it.
Yeah, because the thing about that is those are films where both explicitly operate in a something quasi closer to reality, where when strange stuff happens, it's somewhat commented upon, or we seem to recognize that none of this quite works out, but the entire film as a whole wouldn't work unless these things happened. And I think what is key in both instances is they are deliberately confusing enough, not because they are trying to create a puzzle for anybody to try and figure out. Like, this is not a case where we all of a sudden come to the realization they were clones the entire time, or that kind of puzzle box rationale.
Yeah, the openness of this film, I think, yeah, it's not one of those movies where, okay, well, you need to watch it twice and then you'll figure it out. You know, it's maybe it's a bit closer to last year at Marion Bad in some respects, where it's just, you have the beginnings of clues to piece out a one single answer to this film, but you're never given the full set.
Well, it's the thing where I think part of the point is, I mean, even if you watch it, I don't think you'll ever arrive at a conclusion. And I think part of the point is neither Villeneuve or Lynch in his particular work care what the rational explanation is. These things are happening because in order for the story for them to tell, to take place, they need to happen. And there's a difference between doing that and the sort of haphazard, because I say so plotting, where we're ostensibly in reality. These films take, both of these, Lynch's work and this film in particular for Villeneuve, take place in a not quite reality, where something seems off and surreal the entire time. And you're never going to peg it down, because the real point of the matter is just to dig into the thematics and dig into the subtext of what's going on. if you're trying to find a plot rationale for anything, you're never going to get it, and you'll leave dissatisfied. And I don't think either one of them could care less in either film about that, going through their those works in particular.
Yeah, because like there's weird absences at the heart of this film, but none of it feels haphazard or accidental. And, I mean, going back to the fact that this film, in certain respects, is the product of three different creative minds, not just Villeneuve, yet it feels completely unified as a work. And, I mean, like, if you go online, you can find all sorts of different interpretations of the film. Like, Villeneuve himself has said very cryptically, this is a film about living under a dictatorship without even realizing it. Some people read it as Anthony is an expression of Adam's repressed desire. Some people see it as, oh no, they are the same person, or they're distinctly different people, or Anthony is a psychic, or he's a double created by a psychic break one day in Adam's life. Some people, yeah, like, especially what parsing out what the images themselves mean. Like, there are a lot of different interpretations, but I agree that there's no singular one. And this doesn't feel like a film that was structured in a way where there's a right answer. But I guess my question is, as you brought up, like, Villeneuve isn't interested here in giving, like, that one explanation for the film. But I wonder, can we actually glean any meaning from a film if we fundamentally don't understand what this film is supposed to be about?
Here's the thing. I mean, going with the whole sort of notion of author-reader interactivity and the idea that the meaning of a text is created between the two of them, I think, yeah, absolutely we can create meaning out of this text. Now, before I go into, I mean, I think there are two very possible interpretations to me that are significant, but I do want to speak to the one thing that you brought up there a moment ago, which is this idea of totalitarianism, which I've heard that quote attributed to a critic rather than Villeneuve, so I don't know, maybe it was him, or maybe it was something he said that a later critic picked up upon, or vice versa. I don't know.
What David's too kind to say is that it may also just be Andrew simply being wrong, but yes. Totalitarianism.
Yeah. See, here's the thing. I am going to call complete BS on that for a couple reasons.
Okay,
number one.
This is going to be fun.
Well, two things. I think here's my problem with it, is that, number one, the only reason, the thing is, totalitarianism is something very explicit and has a very real definition of what it is.
Only if you're thinking about it in terms of political totalitarianism.
But here's the thing about it. If we're talking about the film in terms of ideas of control and power and that sort of thing, I agree with you that, yes, broadly speaking, the way in which it's brought up does speak to that on a thematic level, while not being about political totalitarianism. The problem I have with that is that that word is such a loaded one when it comes to its political context that it feels really dicey just to throw it in there. And honestly, the only reason I think anybody could read this as remotely about totalitarianism as such would be because of that scene where Adam drops it as part of his history lesson early on, which, number one,
he
I guess
also repeats that lecture. And he repeats, going back to the earlier observation we made, when there's so much that we are denied as viewers, that places extra import on what we are given. And I don't think it's accidental or coincidental that this scene is repeated twice.
I agree.
Know how much you love when characters give lectures in movies.
Okay, yeah. So, okay, two things. So, number one of my pet peeves in films is the notion of thematically addressed lectures in movies, where people get, first of all, it bugs me from an educational standpoint because nobody teaches like this okay, you don't go into lectures and just have people rambling off in broad generalizations about things. There. No, when you go into a history room and you're getting a history lecture, guess what, folks? Be prepared to copy down a lot of minutia as you're gunning through those courses, getting into the nuance of a political, historical area.
Yeah, likewise, what it needs is Jake Gyllenhaal wearing Jordache saying, has the attendance gone around yet?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, no, like, it just so bugs me. Like, most of the times, education and teachers and lectures and films bug me because most of the time it feels faux and phony, and they are used as that shorthand to interject, and here's the theme of the movie.
Well, we can't all be James Mason, Dave.
Well, yes. But having said that, the thing that bugs me about it as well is, this is, while I get what it's talking about in terms of circularity and how that speaks thematically to what goes on in the film.
Maybe to wind back a little, the content of the lecture is looking at dictatorships and how fundamentally it doesn't matter which historical or period or which geographic region you look at. Dictatorships throughout history are concerned with one thing, and that's control. Yeah. And, you know, he brings up the Romans with bread and circuses, in modern times with the censorship of information, and, like, the erosion of individual freedoms. However they achieve it, and however they frame their desire, all it is a desire for control. And then the other operative piece is Hegel and then Marx's famous quote of, every major event in world history happens twice, first as tragedy, second as farce.
Yeah, and the thing about it is a lot of this information speaks on a personal level to the characters in this film. And it speaks to their personal experiences in this film. And of course, the notion of circularity, of events repeating themselves, is something that occurs throughout the film. Not just the repeating of the lecture, but ultimately, depending upon how we choose to interpret the end of this film, you know, the idea of Adam repeating the same mistakes as Anthony, in some way, shape, or form, is the possibility granted at that ending. Having said that, though, again, totalitarianism is a loaded statement. And if we're talking about, it's one of those things where I am particularly uncomfortable, given how totalitarian governments and repression happen, to suddenly sit there and say that this is about, you know, existing in a totalitarian state without realizing it, when what we have here is a situation that is focused exclusively on the inner psychology of these characters, and it's in relationship to, again, an alienating cityscape, which we will get into in a moment. But Toronto as the fixture of a totalitarian, you know, sort of existence, that's really stretching it for
me. Maybe under the Ford administration.
So I think it's one of those cases where if you didn't have that lecture there, we would never, ever even think to bring that to this movie.
Well, but I'm saying, Dave, I understand that using words like totalitarianism evoke very certain things, and more specifically, like, real-world consequences and terrible outcomes that are very removed from, you know, the psycho-horror genre or the weird magic realism on display here. But I think the other issue is that you might be missing the connection between macro and micro here, because even if we set aside the political meaning of totalitarianism, how did these structures emerge if not first as a result of individual humans and their conflicting desires?
See, I would agree with the notion that there's a connection between the macro and the micro. The problem is that because this is not a film taking place in a totalitarian state as such, you know, unless we're supposed to read, because this comes out in 2013, I forget when Rob Ford left the Toronto government at that point, whether he was still in play power or not.
I made that joke 2 minutes ago and you sandbagged it. But,
Yeah.
I mean, but like, given those weird images, inexplicable shots of giant spiders looming over the city, as one cutaway at one juncture right before Breakfast with Mother. But I mean, like, it's not sustained as, like, in this film, Toronto is, like, under military control or anything.
Well, and that's exactly it. And from what I understand, the author of the original text that this film's based off of has, apparently he has written under a totalitarian government. He has had to write allegorical texts about what it's like to be under that in order to avoid any sort of a prosecution by the state apparatus itself. I think, you know, trying to make that connection in Canada in 2013, particularly in Toronto, which, for those of you who not from Canada, the Toronto versus the rest of Canada debate is one of those things that is long-stemming and ongoing, and, you know, we don't have time to get into the whole of it here, but I think
every
it's
four
safe.
Years, look at a provincial election result map, and you can understand that dense metropolitan Toronto is very far removed from the rest of Ontario.
Exactly. So it's one of those things where this strikes me as a really, if Villeneuve is trying to make some sort of commentary on totalitarian governments or the state of being in a totalitarian state, he has really missed the mark in terms of where he set this movie.
You're emphasizing the immediate association we have with totalitarianism rather than thinking about, I guess, more of a structural dictatorship that happens within human psychology. Because
but I
the
think
turning
that
point
is
at a, the end, yeah. though, it's, I mean, think about it. We have Anthony and Mary end up coming to, I think what we can safely say is a bad end. But
yeah.
conversely, Adam and Helen, they seem to have a good outcome. Because, again, like, even those early scenes with Adam and Mary, like, she seems bored by the fact that he has to work, and she seems disappointed when he doesn't just want to go to bed. She, like, we're not given much to go on, but we get the sense that Mary probably, she wants to have fun. And, you know, like, you can consider that as consisting of whatever you think it does. She wants to have fun. Who doesn't? But Helen, on the other hand, not only is she a wife, but she's also a soon-to-be mother. And, like, she evokes a much more, let's say, domestic set of images. And it seems like the happy ending is Adam getting like, a partner and stability and a family and a home life. But he, the second that he finds the key, though, even though, and do not let me forget to come back to the key. But for now, the second that he finds the key, though, he immediately then thinks about jeopardizing that with that whole vague, I think I might be out a bit late tonight. So it's a dictatorship in the way that we do not control our own subconscious, and desire is very much informed by our subconscious. When we desire something, it doesn't matter if it's rational or if it makes sense. Part of us is impulsively going to seek it. And going back to the idea of control, the subconscious is something that none of us are able to control. And I think if you look at what everyone's big crisis in the film is, like, Adam is given a situation he can't make sense of or understand. And in that sense, he's paralyzed with anxiety, not because he knows what to do, but because he doesn't know how to make it sensible. And by not understanding how he's supposed to interpret this, he has no control over it. Whereas Anthony, he immediately turns the situation to his benefit by pulling one over on the ladies and thus putting himself in a position of control. It comes to very different outcomes, but I think there's a way that you can see the actions of both Adam and Anthony as expressions of control and what happens when people don't have the capacity to exercise it.
But the thing here is, Andrew, I completely agree with you on that. But you talking about issues of control and understanding and making sense of our reality and our chaos is easily achievable without bringing up the subject of totalitarianism. I understand that there is a link in a very broad sense between the two. But again, you know, to sit there and then make a statement along the lines of, you know, this is a film about living in a totalitarian state and not being aware of it. Give me a break. That is, no, we're talking about issues of human psychology and our sense of control over, you know, the reality in which we exist. That does not equate to the same thing.
Well, the uncontrollable subconscious is a form of internalized dictatorship. That's how I read the statement. Not that,
I think
deep
that's...
down, we're all Nazis.
But no, I think the problem with that is that now we're getting into such abstraction and, you know, metaphysical territory that the very specific political dimensions that are associated with that word become meaningless.
True. And
because
we're also
speculating
a lot about authorial intent, and we've been over time and time again why that's always a fool's errand.
Yeah. Well, so I guess it would be more interesting. To me, there are two distinct ways to approach this film. One is, yeah, the idea of the psychology of this film and how we interpret the relationship between Adam and Anthony. And to me, this is an instance where no matter how it comes down to, they are, I think, and I would assume you would agree with this, Andrew, at least the interconnected and probably two sides of the same coin. However you want to interpret it, whether they're the same person or some there is some weird metaphysical connection between them, whatever, I don't care. And I don't think Villeneuve cares. Point of the matter is, in some way, their coexistence speaks back to one another in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's fascinating, because as doubles, they aren't... It's interesting. It's not, you know, to come back to a case such as, say, something I brought up to you, Andrew, the other day, which is the issue of the Twilight Zone 1985 version, episode Shatterday, in which, you know, that opens up with a character, you know, discovering that seemingly somebody else is living out their life, and basically it's these two halves trying to seek control over it, over who gets to continue to exist. And yeah, it's basically an inner combat writ large there. And to some degree, I think that's what's happening here, where we have, yeah, Adam as the one seeking something and wanting something. And here's Anthony, who at least holds portions of that over them. And I'm curious, because I didn't hear your thoughts on this. There seems to be a way in which the film divides them, where it's not exactly clear-cut as to how their existences make perfect sense. Because let's take Anthony, for example. From what we're shown of his life, he has a swank apartment with his wife in one of the more upscale sides of Toronto. And how does he afford this, Andrew?
By being a third-rate actor.
Whose famed roles include bellhop in weird random Canadian film. And as we all know, Canadian movies pay
a
lot of money.
There's a way.
Yes. So you have stuff like that. Again, they never really mention whether Helen has a job or not, so we don't really know, but it's the sort of existence that, you know, compared to the guy who at least has seemingly a steady income at a Toronto university, would probably be more likely to have. Again, universities don't pay that much, but it seems more likely that they would be in a position to have that than third-rate actor, unless you had something like, say, a wealthy mother who could provide additional funds to you.
She does have a nice kitchen.
She has a very nice kitchen. And we get the sense from her early phone call or message left on Adam's machine, she's not impressed by his apartment, which... To be honest, if you're living on a teacher's wage in Toronto, is probably actually pretty decent, all things considered.
Yeah, I mean, it's not on fire. Well, actually, Dave, now that you're laying it out like that, I think you've given me something else to actually consider. And seeing as this was probably the seventh or eighth time I've watched this movie, I didn't think that could happen. But, okay. Let's bracket this for a second, what this film is about, and let's turn to some of the images, namely the idea of shoes and spiders.
Yes.
Now,
okay.
Spiders in this film, and I think both you and I might be on the same page that it's difficult to see it not misogynistically, because every time spiders appear, it's in relation to females. At first, there's the spider that is crushed by the fetish model. There is the spider web that forms in the shattered glass after the car accident. And then there's the notable shot at the end, as well as that abstract cutaway of giant spiders over the city right before that scene with Adam's mother. Now, spiders, like, especially the idea of, like, the Black Widow, which I don't think any of the spiders in the film are. But spiders, you know, are, I think, historically in literature, linked to the idea of the feminine and the idea of the feminine threat. And I think it's difficult. There's clearly an attempt to link women with the spider, and explicitly, by the end, there is that linkage made right before our eyes. The problem is that we're first introduced, though, to spiders by having a woman tower over and crush one of them. And I guess I wonder, what do you make of that set of images?
I honestly don't know, because this is the thing, and I was going to bring this up to you, because it occurs to me now, that opening scene in the club, I would love to go back and see whether the person that Adam rides in the elevator with is in that scene, because I am almost wondering.
I believe it is.
It is?
Because there's a man following a few steps behind him, and again, they don't speak. They don't address one another or acknowledge each other or sit down together, but I'm pretty sure it's the same actor.
Well, even if it is, there's part of me that almost wonders whether that is Adam, and this is a flash forward that starts the film.
I am glad that you asked that.
Yeah, because, again, there's nothing that places it temporarily that suggests that it had to be at the exact start of the movie or at the very end of it or anywhere else. It simply exists almost on an island on its own, and we could place it wherever we wanted. And, yeah, in this instance, if that's the case, the relationship between spider and women and this idea of... Again, almost then becomes the question of, is the notion of a relationship more so the issue of what the spider represents? And if that's the case, the idea of a marriage or, you know, long-term committed relationships being a web to be trapped in, which, man, are we getting into misogynistic territory once we get into that line of thinking.
Well, not necessarily, any more than Nicholas Ray was by interrogating the domestic family unit. Hey, that's two callbacks to Bigger Than Life. But
I think it does then become the question of to what degree we're supposed to identify with
a horrified response to the idea of domesticity? Or are we supposed to see matrimony as a threat the same way that Adam does in this interpretation of it? I mean, that's a difficult question. And again, it's made even less clear by the fact that you are exactly right. It's not totally clear when that opening scene takes place or which character we're even following there. Because Anthony reacts very viscerally when he notices Mary's shoes on the subway, and the key is being sent to him. Which would, and like when Adam is told about the club by the elevator operator, like he seems pretty dumbfounded by it. But at the same time, it's in that opening scene, I believe that the Jake Gyllenhaal character is wearing Adam's sport coat. But at the end of the film, like Adam seems interested in that key. But if we're assuming this is a linear narrative, he would have no idea what that key actually is for. Or he knows what it's for, but he doesn't know where to look to find the door that it opens. So, is it a flash forward? Or is it just a projection? Because if you think about it, the recurring image of the spider and the shoes, maybe, like... Is everything that's happening in the film like a distillation of one man's divided personality that happens to be fetishistically obsessed with a certain set of images? Because even fetishes themselves, again, another very loaded term. I mean, we often use it in a strictly sexual sense, but like the term fetish really is more general. And that's that object we project weakness and strength onto, and in possessing that, What do, David? We exercise control. And I'm wondering, like, that club scene, it's like, well, I mean, it's certainly very odd and a very striking series of images, but it's like, whose desire is being reflected in these images? Is it Adam? Is it Anthony? Or is it both of them?
And my thought process would be to say it's both, only because, again, I don't think there is that strict binary divide that really can be said to exist between them. I think in some way, shape, or form, whether literal or metaphysical, however you choose to interpret it, they are connected in some way in terms of their inner workings in psychology. You can't have one without the other in terms of understanding the other one. So, what that ultimately says, I don't know.
Okay, and the biggest question, though, that I was left with on this viewing, and I don't recall noticing it before, but the photograph. The photograph is the one piece that I cannot make sense of, and I will freely admit. Because at the very beginning, like once Adam recognizes Anthony on screen, he digs through some boxes and he pulls out a photograph of himself, looking like, drunk with the big happy smile, and the photo was ripped. Later, when he's in Anthony's apartment, he sees a photograph on the shelf that is the complete photo of Anthony with Helen. So, what is going on with that photograph?
Honestly, this is part of why again, this film works more expressionistically to me. Like, honestly, if I was asked to peg it down, this is fundamentally just about one guy trying to figure out, his weird hang-ups in relationships with women, and we're just seeing this writ large in terms of this. I'm not even going to sit there and say it's like a psychotic break in terms of imagining you have two identities, because I don't even think it's that literal. It's just a matter of, yeah, we're seeing one or two halves of somebody who might not even be called Adam or Anthony. These are just the sides of the same personality, and we're just seeing working out. Much like, to come back to Shatterday for a second, that Twilight Zone episode, based on a short story by Harlan Ellison, for those of you wanting to try and look up more information on that. But yeah, no, I to me that's the only way to rationalize the entirety of the embodiment. And that's not to say that's a correct reading. It's just, to me, that's the most logical way to look at this. It's just that, this is reality that doesn't add up, because it's not really reality. This is, again, somebody's inner psychosis. And to take paratext into it, for anybody who's seen the posters for this film, one of the interesting things you may have seen is the one where it is of Jake Gyllenhaal and the top of his head sort of dissolving into the Toronto cityscape with the spider in the midst of it there. And that's a pretty loaded image. And while it's not in the film itself, this strikes me as as an instance where it's kind of hard not to see that it was an image likely accepted by the filmmakers, approved by the filmmakers, and as part of a way to prepare the audience for how they were to go in to read the film. Again, your relationship with, the surrounding media to advertise a film and the film itself, take it or leave it as you choose. I'm not going to sit there and say you have to accept it as
But it
part
can be
of
illustrative,
the.
though. And even just thinking now, though, when we first see that photo, it's ripped, right? And then when we see it near the end, all of a sudden it's complete. And I mean, maybe we're just supposed to read this purely in a symbolic register that, well, he's found his completeness, which is immediately undone by the fact that he's fascinated by the key. And maybe he's only fascinated because he doesn't know what it does and he needs that info. I mean, like, this is a film full of possibilities, and I realize we could talk easily twice as long as we currently have, parsing out the rest of it. But yeah, I think the other piece, though, that maybe in more general terms, and I think we could both agree stylistically, certainly with the mise-en-scène and the way this film depicts urban space. I mean, we keep talking around the city of Toronto, but there's a certain character to the city itself, and it's presented in a very distinct manner that also, I mean, whether or not we want to say that urban space is the cause of all this alienation and Adam's latent craziness, there's definitely something within the depiction of urban areas that is decidedly unwell, should we say?
Well, everything shot through, I don't know if it's a yellow filter or whether it's the use of particularly this sort of jaundice-colored lighting that's going throughout this film. Yeah, but yeah,
there's a sickly Toronto pallor looks to much of what you see.
Yeah, and I would say that part and parcel is, you know, if there is another sort of side component to this film thematically or subtextually, part of me wonders whether this is a film that's very much about the ease of digital culture to get lost and obsessed in things, because, and you know, how this sort of gets embodied by the city in which you can easily get lost within, because it's very notable that how does this entire film get started? Well, Adam comes across a footage of Anthony in the background of a film, which he's able to sit there and watch on his laptop, which he can then utilize obsessively to go and look up all the key information he needs mm-hmm. about how to find this talent agency and track down past the guy's screen credit or his pseudonym for his film work to get to his real name, to be able to invade a space, to go and find somebody who, at least on the surface, looks just like him. And allegorically, I think, you know, going and meeting in hotel rooms is not necessarily all that different from going and meeting somebody somewhere online anonymously and then finding, you know, that maybe what you thought you were looking for isn't necessarily as comforting or connecting as you thought. Because, yeah, you may have share that surface connection. You know, you look like one another. And then discover, no, there's something really rotten and different between us in this individual. Assuming that you read Adam is somehow more pure than Anthony, which I don't think holds up either, because I think both of them are fundamentally off and wrong in compatible ways.
I mean, Adam's more likable only because he's not an outright jerk. He's definitely a man with some problems, though. And given the number of cutaway shots of him sweaty and grabbing his temples with both hands and then sighing against a wall, I mean, there's something clearly unwell about him.
Well, even beyond that, let's not forget that after he watches the film where he discovers Anthony in the first time, what is his immediate action from that point forward? It's not to, you know, he gets the movie done, he closes his laptop. Does he just go to bed and fall asleep? No. He basically proceeds to engage what I think pretty much anybody would willingly call sexual assault, if not outright rape, of Mary at that point in time.
Yes, that's true. And, yeah, we shouldn't gloss over that. Because, again, that is that interruption of the pattern as well. So there is something meaningful there, but again, it's not explicated upon.
Well, and that's the thing, and I think why, again, it's looking on Anthony as, yeah, I would say it's at least some side of Adam's personality, or Adam's some side of Anthony's personality, how you choose to connect those two, again, up to you. Point being that, yeah, there is probably more similarity than Adam would be comfortable admitting, but again, taking it into that digital context, I mean, who hasn't, you know, let's be honest, who hasn't gone into a message board if you were a fan of something? It's, oh, hey, here's my community. Here's people like me, just like me out there. And then being horrified by what you discover.
Well, I once cyber-stalked Alan Ruck because I was convinced that we were the same person. That's another story for another time. Well, maybe, do you think, all right, I'm just trying to think as a final pitch here. And, I mean, I know that we are not going to hit on something and be like, oh, Dave, we cracked Enemy. But
yeah,
I think, Adam seems to be, at least initially, a very disconnected and alienated person. And all space is kind of leveled into the same flat thing presented in the same flat register with that droning score behind it that just kind of reduces everything to the level of same. And it seems like part of his interest in figuring out what's going on with Anthony is trying to understand and trying to gain knowledge, and in doing so, figure out the meaning and make it meaningful. And do you think that Enemy is almost like, It's almost like a game of three-card Monte that Denis Villeneuve is doing with impeccable aesthetic direction, because it seems like we have that same response. We're confronted with powerful and bizarre images we don't understand, and thus we try and use whatever's at our disposal to make that meaningful to us as well, because the idea of things just happening without meaning is just so fundamentally abhorrent to the human psyche.
I would say it makes as much sense as anything, and I mean, certainly, I mean, if anything, I mean, not to be super general and engage in the exact same kind of BS I was talking about earlier about, but yeah, and fundamentally, much of art is about making sense of chaos, if you want to ascribe a function to art, as it were. So, I would say that that's certainly a component of it. And yeah, I think this is very much a work where we're never going to fully nail it down. And
well, not
that's
with that
fine.
Quitter's attitude.
Well, but I think this is the thing. Like, you know, while there are some quibbles here or there with the film, I think the one thing for the Villeneuve films I've seen is that he is a very savvy filmmaker in terms of keeping ambiguity where it's good to have ambiguity. He's not doing it for the sake of, and it's, you know, like, you know, M. Night, or not to use M. Night Shyamalan because that's a terrible example, but there are filmmakers out there who, you know, here's the twist, and it serves only because to have a twist that means nothing, or who fundamentally, you know, here's all sorts of cool, you know, wacky images that add up to nothing. They mean nothing.
It's the difference between using it to tell a very interesting or rewarding story versus a guy who walks up to you and punches you in the face. And you're like, why did you do that? I said, bet you weren't expecting that.
Yeah, precisely. And I think Villeneuve, you know, between whether it's this, whether it's Arrival, whether it's Blade Runner 2049, you know, he is able to work that level of ambiguity and, you know, allow for interpretation while still being hyper-controlled and specific in what he's doing, masterfully. And even if this is a case of he's done this film and he is at something of a remove in terms of allowing further collaboration from those he's working with, that's fine. I mean, allowing that level of control to people you work with is a godsend if you are, you know, giving them the appropriate free rein and only stepping in when you need to. There. I mean, that's not a sense of lack of control so much as you are in control enough to be able to step aside and get out of your own way when it's required. And if this is the end result of that, good on you.
It's chaotic, but it's controlled chaos. It's not just a series of disconnected images and non sequiturs. There is something that pins it all together. And I think it's the fact that Villeneuve, he will resolve that ambiguity if it is needed. And so in a case like this, where it's not resolved, it's because it doesn't need to be. And I think that's what's so fascinating, though, because it means that every time I watch this film, I figure out 95% of it, and then something else happens, and I have to keep revisiting it. And I'm not going to lie. I mean, I think it's pretty clear from this conversation. Denis Villeneuve is one of my favorite filmmakers, certainly that's still making films today, and not just because he's a local boy done good. I think he can be a very audacious filmmaker in ways that people really aren't expecting, and the fact that he was able to make this at not only the same year, but pretty much at the exact same time, he's making a more A-list, mass marketable studio picture down in the States that would end up being very successful and sort of leading to bigger projects like Arrival and the recent Blade Runner. Like, good on him. However, if this were the only film he made to come out in 2013, and then everyone said, oh, by the way, this kid is one to watch, I don't think you would have believed that. But I also feel like even if Prisoners hadn't come out, Denis Villeneuve still would have made this film anyway. And I don't know, it's a film like this is proof that understanding what something's about isn't always essential to the enjoyment of it. And sometimes there is, even the things we can't control still fascinate us, I suppose.
Yeah, and I can say that, you know, While he is going off right now to make the two-film Dune adaptation, which has apparently been his dream project, I certainly do hope he eventually comes back to Canada and makes the sequel to Duct Tape Forever that we've all been waiting for.
Oh, I'm glad one of us worked that in. Oh, man. Well, I guess it's probably about time that we tape this one up, because otherwise we are going to be doing this all night, and yep. Then we're eventually going to find our own doppelganger somehow, and it only goes downhill from there. So That, I suppose, brings us to our patent-pended bumper segment, Hits and Pits, the little things that made us grin and groan in asymmetrical measure. So, Dave, as is my custom, I will allow you to choose the first hit for Enemy.
Good question. And honestly, what I would like to sort of do right off the bat in terms of giving a bit of praise to this film is, yeah, I want to give credit to Matthew Hanneman, the editor on this film, because, again, some of the edit choices in this movie are carefully done and very fascinating in terms of whether it's matching on action or not. And particularly scene transitions in terms of structuring where we cut into Adam's life or to Anthony's life and cross cut between them. It's fascinating to watch, because even just those connections end up adding so much detail and richness in terms of how we choose to interpret and look at their lives together. And, you know, I could easily see a version of this that is more conventionally edited, where things could be far more linear and quote-unquote coherent. And, yeah, the fact that this is allowed to play at a pace that is, it feels deliberate but not slow, is the other thing. Like, this is a very tightly constructed movie overall. And, I mean, it's a tight 91 minutes in length with credits. So, you know, that's not easy to pull off when you have a film that's this rich and this textured. So, kudos there. But what about you, Andrew? Where would your first hit be?
Well, again, I mean, when you have sort of like the three figures that, by Villeneuve's own admission, were the instrumental forces, it's hard to know who to exactly credit with. But I will say the scripting of this film. Because, as I pointed out, like, this is a film that, again, doesn't give you much, but whatever it gives you is able to cut to the absolute quick of the matter. Whether it's that suddenly cutting to Helen in wide and then realizing for a split second, oh, she's pregnant, and this changes the dynamic considerably. Or what's conveyed in the line, have you been seeing her again? Or the call ID reading mother. Like, there are very little moments that speak volumes. And as a result, like, this is a film that invites you insofar as you are actually willing to think about what it's giving you. And that's not always an easy feat to do. And I mean, like, typically when we think of narrative economy, we think of, like, classic Hollywood. And this film is decidedly removed from that. But yeah. It shows that, I mean, that is also the area where I would say that's what convinces me. This is a film that definitely has a deliberate purpose. Because, again, there is that laser focus, and our attention is drawn where it's needed to by those little cues, and I think they're deployed pretty masterfully throughout. It works, obviously, in conjunction with the editing and the way that this film is told visually, but, like, they're pretty much inseparable. But, I mean, the two registers of this film work beautifully together, and yeah, kudos for knowing, for everybody involved, knowing what the lines to keep in. It's almost like subtractive design. They cut out all the fluff and just left us with what's absolutely essential.
Absolutely. So, I guess this brings me back to my second hit, and I'm going to give a shout-out to Sarah Gadon in her performance as Helen, because, again, the shining star of this film gets to be Jake Gyllenhaal. He gets the meaty material to play for the most part. And he does fine. I mean, he does great work here. I don't want to take that away from him. Gadon, though, has the much trickier role in that she needs to be something who, again, is sort of the outsider trying to comprehend this situation both emotionally and in terms of what it all means together. And there's a way that this could have been played as a very passive victim.
Mm-hmm.
She does not do that in this film. I mean, there is an agency there that she does not relinquish in this movie. It allows her destiny to be controlled by whether it's Adam or Anthony here. She puts her foot down and is able to really, you know, take charge when she needs to.
Yeah, she's vulnerable without being frail and fragile.
Exactly. Like, no, and again, likewise, there isn't that danger of becoming a, you know, playing this as if it was Sigourney Weaver, who is somebody who is always so in sense of control that you have a hard time believing that she would take any guff from anybody in any given situation, no matter what the role is. And yeah, no, it's a very tricky half, and she gets to do, you know, really strong work with it. And yeah, when it comes to the closing 20 or so minutes of this movie, she has some heavy emotional lifting to do in this film, and she pulls it off beautifully in this movie. So particularly as you're playing those tricky things where RV slippages, where the phony reality is slipping around, whether Adam Anthony, whoever he is, or whether she's aware of what's happened, who she's with, and why being the case. It's very carefully done, and kudos to her performance there. So, but what about you, Andrew? What is your second hit here?
Well, I wholeheartedly concur with pretty much everything that you just said. And I'm also wondering, maybe both men are actually a sugar dream by the band Adam and the Ants. But that'll be another episode, maybe next year for Christmas. I'm thinking that for my second hit, normally I pick more general things. This time I'm going to pick the specific scene in the conference room when Adam is told about the movie, only because in a film that feels so surreal and hyper real and very confusing at times, this is the one scene that absolutely captures the banality of modern small talk, because Adam clearly isn't interested in the conversation. The guy's just very helpfully and jovially, "Hey, do you like movies?" And the conversation goes nowhere, and Adam finally just stares awkwardly, and, "So, is there a reason why you're asking me this?" And just the other guy, "Oh, no, no." 5-second pause. "Well, I did see a good one the other night," and then more pausing. And the part that slays me every time is that the guy goes, "Where there's a will, there's a way." And Jake Gyllenhaal, he, like, this is the best moment of acting in the entire film, because he has that immediate, like, smirk as he just turns up. "Yep, that's right." And because, like, "No, that's the title of the film." "Oh." And just, like, I think we've all had that conversation. And yeah, it was just, it's so funny to me, just for reasons I can't even quite explain, because it feels so real in a film where everything else is suspect, and it's a welcome counterpoint. You know, the other scenes, we do laugh, but I think it's more that nervous, awkward laughter, like seeing Jake Gyllenhaal trying to be subtle wearing cheap drugstore Dolce & Gabbana knockoff sunglasses with, you know, big gold trim on the sides and that, or his absolute ineptness at thinking on his feet. But, like, yeah, that scene just gets me every time. And besides, it's subjective criteria, so you don't even need a reason.
Precisely.
And I guess on the heels of that, Dave, what are your pits for Enemy?
I know I've already spoken about this at length, but I really hate that classroom scene. Like, there's just, it is the one scene that feels shoehorned into this movie, in terms of it's only there to, in the most blunt way possible, lay out some thematic groundwork that will register throughout the rest of the film. And yeah, stuff like that really irks me. Like, when you do, like, it's one of those things where I get you don't want to be so obtuse that you know people don't get what's going on. At the same time, there has got to be a better way, people, than these phony, horrible classroom scenes where somebody just conveniently happens to sum up the movie for you. And I know that this film doesn't quite go so far as to sum up everything, but it's almost like Villeneuve is, yeah, underscoring with a red marker on screen, keep this in mind. And yeah, it takes me out of it. So this may not be your pet peeve. You may not mind it here, folks. For me, though, until we get to something like Mr. Holland's Opus, where I really, really will go to task on how much I hate the way education is portrayed in films. Yeah, yeah, that one is my starting point for this episode.
No, I've never actually seen Mr. Holland's Opus, so I look forward to a 2-hour debate of that one with you.
Yes. So, but what about you, Andrew? What would be your first hit here? Probably something we haven't spoken about at length.
Well, yes. First and probably only because, unapologetically, this probably is a film in my top 10. It's very near and dear to my heart, even if I can't make head nor tail of it. I don't know, man. I guess my only complaint, and this is, it's going to sound minor, but that's why it's here. I feel like the VFX aren't quite up to snuff. Or the problem is, it's that the first time you see the giant spider, it's shocking. When you know to expect it, you look at it more closely, and you can sort of see the seams. And especially when the car crashes, you can pretty clearly tell that it's digital effects, and it doesn't really gel with the rest of the film, because the rest of the film largely unified in tone and aesthetic, so these moments jut out a bit more. There are also those buildings near Adam's apartment, those hourglass-shaped ones that I believe are CGI inserts. And even just looking at them, you can tell that they're not really there. I understand it's a film on a limited budget, and they don't have industrial light and magic doing everything. But, I don't know, it creates more rupture between me and the film than I would really care for. And I think, especially in the case of like the shots of the giant spiders over the city, like, it's a striking image, but is it a necessary one? I don't know. I feel like there may have been... I feel like trying to do a shot like that using practical effects, or, I mean, if they can make superimpositions as of that sort in the 1920s when Europe was still rebuilding itself, I feel like they could have done something comparable in 2013. But, I mean, like, it's not my film. It's not that it ruins the movie because a very brief car accident didn't involve destroying a real Datsun or whatever. So, it's a decidedly minor one, and that's the only thing that really pulls me out of the film. So, I've spent my pits, but Dave, do you have anything else to add to the pile?
Actually, I really don't, but I would push back on that a little bit, only because... The thing for me that works in this film's favor is that, number one, in the case of the giant spider over the cityscape shot, again, if we accept the notion that this is more of an expressionistic movie in terms of this is not literally Toronto, but the Toronto of Adam slash Anthony's mind, it makes more sense to me. And I think
agreed.
The whole notion of this, the slightly off effects work, given the fact that this film has that sort of surreal quality to it, I think it ends up adding to this movie in a way where, yeah, it doesn't look quite right, but that almost ends in and of itself becomes an aesthetic choice or a benefit, if not a deliberate choice.
So does that mean it would be more effective if they got the VFX team behind Paul Anderson's Mortal Kombat? Because that looks even worse.
Okay, two, let's point out the following things here. One, Mortal Kombat was 1995, and for 1995, most, not all, most of those effects were pretty good. Two, in terms of the case of this film, I'm not saying I want to see even worse effects. Although, if you wanted to sit there and say, I would much rather have giant spiders as created by Ray Harryhausen in this movie, yeah, I would be totally with you on that.
Well, of course, because you're Dave.
Yeah, but I admit that's not likely to happen, seeing as how, well, Ray Harryhausen is dead. But putting that one aside, I don't really have any other major pits. Like, it's mostly a case of a film where I really, really, really appreciate it. It just doesn't quite hit the buttons, I think, for me, the same way it quite does for you. So that's about the only real distinction. There's nothing wrong with the film, per se. It's just, yeah, I don't quite have that as immediate a personal reaction to it as I think you do. But that's fine. That's, again, I still stand by Heat. So there we go, folks.
Ooh, more like Ray Barryhausen.
I guess, yes, you can find Enemy in many locations. It's not hard to find. It's not like My American Cousin. Yes, we are going to drop more Canadian film references per episode from this point forward, folks.
All right, you're at the point where you're going over my head, so I think that's our cue to start wrapping this one up.
Yes.
But yes, so Dave, if people want to say, hey, Dave, you need to give more love to challenging Canadian films on something like Twitter. Where can they find you?
You can find me at 24Panels, though if you start trying to convince me that the Corner Gas movie was something that needed to happen, or that Corner Gas at all needed to happen, save your breath. Don't do it.
It's cute.
And where can they... Is it? Is it really?
Brent Butt is a funny man. Now, Corner Gas the movie, directed by Denis Villeneuve.
Well, it would be better than Corner Gas just about anything else, so there. But Andrew, if anybody wants to pitch to you their alternate takes on Corner Gas or Denis Villeneuve's career, where can they contact you?
They can find me on Twitter at FilmStripper. Later tonight I'll be live streaming me stepping on various insects in my apartment. I might even put on my nice slippers. And on that note, if you would like to rate or review our humble little podcast, head on over to iTunes or whatever podcasting service you find us through. Leaving a 5-star review is the best way to get more eyes and ears onto our show, but your feedback is the most important, because at the end of the day, we want to make the kind of show that you want to keep listening to, and we can't keep doing that if you don't tell us what we're doing wrong.
Exactly. And if Denis Villeneuve would like to leave us rate and review us and criticize us for even associating with things such as Corner Gas and or Duct Tape Forever, we don't blame you for that 1-star review. We are fully deserving of it.
Well, we'll just review him back. Denis Villeneuve is a good filmmaker who makes good films. 3 stars.
There we go. on that note, I guess I'm taking control of the wheel again here. This was a lovely episode, and, you know, there were many places we could go, but I've decided, you know, rather than, say, look at another Villeneuve film, we'll take a look at what his screenwriter was up to, Javier Goulon. In this case, we're going to jump to 2017 to look at the one and only film that will likely ever be contain the names Darren Aronofsky and Arnold Schwarzenegger in the same list of credits. And that is Aftermath, the drama, I think, starring, Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is, you know, will allow us to dive into what does indeed happen with an aging action star later on in their life. So stay tuned for that one. I'm curious. I haven't seen it before.
All I know is that the accent meter is going to be to the max.
Yeah. Notably, no Russian bots have attacked us yet, so for the last episode, so...
I know, good. Right? It's like, what was the point of the last episode?
Yeah. But on that note, Andrew, do you have any parting words you would like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Or lead you to watching films, which will inevitably lead you to discovering your double, which will inevitably lead to you trying to track down your double. But I digress. Bye.
Oh, David, never change.